So we've a new version of macOS.
Yes.
If you squint, you can notice it.
Well, I plan on updating sometime around April, so why don't you tell me tell me what's good about it?
Is this out of laziness or, you know, just can't be bothered?
I don't like big updates or I just the potential for things going wrong, and I tend to just kind of not do them. Even though I have backups and everything, it's just like the last thing I want to do is spend any time actually fixing stuff. Not that anything with macOS has ever gone wrong on me. Nothing has. But still, it's just a big, I think people are a bit too casual about it, and I'm still fairly old school.
So it's funny that the three of us represent, I think, opposite spectrums of the approach to updating. So, Baz, you was it even beta 1 you installed?
Yeah, because I guess I have my work laptop, and so I have my own laptop. So, you know, I'm not so worried that I have a machine that I develop on, and that's work. So if this home one goes wrong, or, you know, I have something, I guess,
it's kind of okay.
It's kind of okay. I have a second machine to fall back on for a while until it comes out. But yeah, like, I pretty much stuck on beta 1 on this MacBook Air. And then when the Gold Master came out, I think that was the only other time I changed.
Wow.
So I didn't notice any issues. Like,
and then I'm, I guess, in between the two of you in that I didn't touch any of the betas, and wouldn't for same reason as Dave. But I did, last 2 years, I started installing on day one. So I am running Sierra.
So what have you noticed is different, or have you used any new features, or?
I think I'm a bit torn about it, because I have to admit, I'm not that excited about this release. There aren't that many new features.
No.
But I'm torn because for years, I, like many other people, have been saying that they wish Apple would release an update of the OS where there weren't a lot of new features and they focused on stability improvements. So I kind of feel like I can't really be given out about, you know, it sucks because there's not many new things, and that's what I've been saying they should do, you know?
Yeah. I was kind of wondering what, so I have two things that I really, really like about it so far. One is I use GIMP a lot inside and work just for small graphical kind of things. And GIMP is just a mess of windows. It's just about five or six different windows, and each image you open has its own window as well. So the new feature grabs, or you can have multiple tabs per program, is fantastic. So in GIMP, you can kind of go, okay, bring all windows into tabs, and it brings every single view into tab, and it's just really, really good. I don't know how it works, but it works like magic in GIMP. I've never used it in any other app, though. I suppose we're in GarageBand recording at the moment. Maybe I can open a second GarageBand, but I won't try. Not until we stop recording. But Picture in Picture. So I guess I've been kind of doing some work at home this weekend and programming, and I can have Picture in Picture going. So I can have YouTube mostly is what I'm using, kind of down the bottom right corner. I watch a lot of Giant Bomb stuff, so I can have them down the bottom right corner. And I installed a Safari extension called Pipifier, so that works for Netflix or any HTML5 based video player. So that will just put them in Picture in Picture as well. So it's kind of cool just having it there away. Stuff like YouTube videos or Netflix comedy, nothing serious, kind of background shows, just have down the bottom and just kind of flick it in between all your corners. So that's nice. But I think that's it.
I think I have a Sierra bug that maybe we can try out live on air. If you guys both want to launch iTunes, and we'll do a test in a few minutes. But in general, I mean, one of the big ones, I suppose, is Siri, which I tried out once. It is the debut, though, of female Irish Siri.
Oh, God, it's awful.
The Mac is the first platform, because it's still not on iOS.
If you select, is it new? Because if you select a text and ask Siri to speak before you got the Irish accent.
And the same with maps. When you were doing directions, you would get Irish accent maps. With Siri itself, that was never an option for the voice. I have no idea why. Because as you say, it was built in, at least from iOS 9.
So is it that voice or is it a new one?
It's that voice.
Oh, okay. So and it's weird great. Because that's a real person, obviously, and does news reports. So I've actually heard Siri reading the news and doing live reports on BBC and stuff. And I went on a quest a few years ago to try and find out who it was. And I actually took the news report and typed it word for word into notes and had Siri speak it at the same time. And it was a pretty close match. So unfortunately, I can't remember who the hell it was. So that's a bit of an anticlimax to that anecdote. But yeah, there probably aren't too many Irish people that it could be.
There you go. So do you both have iTunes open?
Yeah.
So if you just try and make the iTunes window as narrow as you can.
Okay, mine's in full screen.
So, Dave, how narrow on El Capitan, how narrow did you manage to get yours?
Minimum 50% of the screen.
So, Baz, I don't know if you're seeing this, but I can only make mine about 60, 70% narrow. But it's interesting, Dave, because I thought before you could make it much narrower.
Yeah.
I know you can pop it into like a little music player.
I guess my gripe about this isn't necessarily iTunes, but it seems to be a bug in the toolbar. I don't know what sort of class and app kit that is, but it really annoys me for Xcode because now I was wondering because I was using Xcode today and I could only get it to, about 60-70% of the width of my screen. I couldn't get it any narrower.
iTunes is actually the same for me. I'm after measuring it there as a proportion of the screen, and I'm about 60% as the minimum.
Maybe this is nothing then, but it certainly felt like a surprise today that I couldn't resize Xcode. I couldn't have Xcode be half the screen without disabling the toolbar.
Yeah, and Xcode is the same 60% of the screen for me.
Really?
This is
so it's not a Sierra. So it's not a Sierra bug. I stand corrected.
And I have Moom, which gives me a drop down on my the full screen button as it's called now. And it gives me a drop down to portion that to a half the screen or whatever, but it's still even using that, which does it using the accessibility options, I'm still at more than 50%.
Wow. So, it's sort of frustrating, though, because there clearly is room in that toolbar to move, and it is the toolbar that is preventing it, because that's what it is in Xcode.
Yeah, there's like an inch, just empty space sitting there.
Yeah.
So their UI space view controller.
Do you want it? Do you want a smaller Thomas?
Well, yeah, just in case if I'm kind of looking between two projects, or... I know I could sort of open new windows for the code and classes, but just, it was very frustrating.
In Sierra, can't you have in Xcode two projects within the one project now with multiple tabs? Is that a thing?
Can you make it split screen, full screen? Is that a thing?
This is what I'm trying now. I'm trying to get except I've forgotten how to do it.
Yes, you can.
And what percentage is it?
Oh, no. Sorry. I dragged Keynote in there. Too many windows open.
Yeah, I have iTunes and split screen. I know it'll do split screen, but only the same width and it won't resize.
Oh, okay.
Very poor. Given Apple are all about this, kind of... Well, all this alter layout stuff, but also like the Mac has always involved windows that are heavily resizable. Not happy at all.
Yeah.
So apart from Siri then on El Capitan, I'm Sierra.
Siri's not bad. You can get it to kind of open certain programs for you, which I find very cool.
I think...
Or do certain tasks for you.
It's fairly telling though, Thomas, that like the first actual thing that you did was send a text to us using Siri and messages, and it created a new conversation. Yes. With the names reversed or something. So instead of me and Baz, it was Baz and me or whatever.
Which is something which the Siri on the iPhone can do, even though it can't understand what I'm saying. I mean, Baz, can you see yourself using this ever? Like, no matter what power it gives you, can you, you know?
Maybe for searching for a file or something. But like, yeah, I don't know if it's built into Spotify maybe for music, but I don't think so, especially if I'm going to be in work as well. I find it very embarrassing talking to Siri in work.
I think it's one of these things that's going to be bounded by, again, the extensibility features that Apple allow. And like, we've waited years for them to open up Siri on iOS, and we get a kind of a lackluster set of interfaces and restrictions on what apps we can actually use it with. And, you know, you can use it for the home automation stuff, but it has to be HomeKit, and not everything works with HomeKit. And, you know, it's getting a bit, it feels very restrictive. And you have the likes then of Amazon Echo or Alexa, which itself technically can run on anything. If anyone wants to make a hardware product with Alexa in it, they can. And it can use all of the Alexa skills. So if I buy an Amazon Echo, which I will do as soon as they, as soon as I just bother to set up the reshipping from the UK, I can just write my own skill for that and have it do whatever I want without having to, you know, without too much trouble. Whereas even as a developer with Siri, you're still fairly restricted. You can make a fake app that's a taxi app for yourself or something and get ways around it. But, you know, with Alexa, you can just talk to it. And again, look, understanding and accents and all that, who knows? But in terms of the actual functionality, it's light years ahead.
Tell us why you want to bring Alexa into your house. What are you hoping to do with it?
First of all, I'm just jaded with technology, in terms of the interface, like, even, and I'm getting old, you know, and the, like, Spotify did a redesign, and now when I open it, like, I'm just like, what the hell? And that'll take me a few weeks, you know, to lose all the old habits, and just stuff like that, you know. Just the friction of the experience to me is getting the coefficient of friction is increasing for me with apps and stuff. So with Alexa, I'm hoping that will reduce the friction, and that I can just use voice for the things that I want. Like, I can use TuneIn to turn on the radio without having to take a phone out of my pocket or look at a screen, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. I can play Spotify, you know, which Siri can't even do, even with the phone, and have it plugged in. You know, if I have Siri plugged in, I can't go, hey Siri, play this on Spotify. Can't do it, you know. So I think Siri is just, it's pretty useless. Other than setting timers, but Alexa will do this, and it'll do multiple timers, which is what I really want.
Paz, are you tempted by this at all?
No. I definitely am, but I live in an apartment at the moment, so I can't really go around messing with too much. But definitely, yeah, I think when I get my own place, eventually
I can swap out the light bulbs.
I'll dip into it. Yeah, I suppose I could swap out the light bulbs.
But even just for controlling TV and stuff, like, I mean, you could buy, it's £100 for an IR a remote.
I have a TV remote.
Yeah, but not one that you can talk to, you know?
That's true. That's true.
I'm thinking Alexa high up on a shelf and no remotes around that small children can try and eat. And, you know, I can be like, turn up the volume, change the channel, you know, until Jacob's old enough to, like, run into the room, scream something and run away and have Alexa carry out, like, Alexa, delete everything, run. you know, so, yeah.
So, Dave, it sounds like you're sort of planning that Alexa will be in some ways the kind of hub of some sort of home automation stuff. Do you want to talk a bit about, like, what you got planned? Have you decided what you're doing fully yet?
Yeah, it's really difficult because I've bought a house anyway, and it's wired as a normal house would be. So you have, you know, light switches and stuff and thermostats and all that. And what I've been looking at doing is just seeing what's actually available or what's out there to bring the automation side of it into the home. Mainly for, I suppose, the few reasons that at the moment we'll probably have a little more money than we will in the future, depending on circumstances. So if there's something that would be more energy efficient in the long run or something like a Nest thermostat, to investigate that. And, you know, that's really that side of it. And then the second part is just to have, again, more control over the house and stuff for, like, you know, having the lights come on when we're not home and, you know, that kind of thing. Just a bit of added security. So just the basic stuff. But even the decisions and the ecosystems that you have to buy into up front are kind of ridiculous at this stage. It's still really the internet of, you know, absolute crap. So there's a few competitors. Philips Hue are probably the biggest and best known. That works with HomeKit. That needs a little bridge plugged in, its own router. Then you have LifeX that connect directly to the Wi-Fi, but they don't work with HomeKit. And again, look, you can get a Raspberry Pi and install your own thing on it. Not a big deal for someone who knows what they're doing, but they don't support HomeKit is the crux of that. They do support Alexa. Alexa supports everything. And, that seems to be the bottom line, really. Alexa controls everything, you know, and Siri kind of does some things if they're HomeKit compatible. And you can't even have the company can't even write an app for Siri that doesn't work with HomeKit, you know. So hard to know what to do, really. I'm thinking of just wiring up relays myself with an ESP8266 on them and just doing DIY route.
And I guess, like, you could have the option then, or like running a small web server in your house and then just writing yourself a little app to do the, you know, while you're away, turning off lights or heating and stuff.
That's it, you know. And to be honest, that would be an order of magnitude cheaper, and you'd have an order of magnitude more control. And, you know, it's just really hard to know what to do. It's almost, to be honest, I'm almost at the stage where the answer is I'm not going to do anything.
Home automation is one of those things. I think it's kind of interesting in that, like, it's been promised for a very long time, you know, this kind of promise of being able to sort of control your home with computers and sensors and stuff is not a new one. Like, I was just, we were talking about X10, which is a quite an old home automation protocol that was released in 1975. Dave, you're saying, like, now it's sort of out of date, but I was saying, like, you know, 5 years ago when I was looking at it, it was still sort of one of the more feasible systems to actually implement. So,
see, it's probably biased as well, because I'm looking at all the shiny things that are advertising themselves. There could be an entire system out there that works exactly the way I want in X10, but it's not been marketed. It's not, you know, I've had a quick look around and I can't, you know, there's nothing that gives the shininess of the others or all of the features. You know, it's still a compromise to some extent.
I think the HomeKit stuff is an area as well where I think it doesn't play to Apple's strengths or Apple's general approach to these things of kind of certifying devices and stuff. Because as you said, like, this stuff is all still eye-wateringly expensive. And given how the price of other types of computing device have plummeted so quickly, it doesn't make sense to me why this stuff is so expensive.
Yeah, like, I've revised my initial thing was every bulb was going to be a smart bulb, and, you know, that, you know, I was going to do XYZ, priced it up, and just for the features and stuff and the lack of the ability to control the LifeX stuff with Siri, the, you know, the other bits and pieces that go along with it, just the priciness of the Philips Hue and the LiFX stuff, I'm kind of resigned to like maybe just doing like the sitting room, just one, the two, just the lamp in the sitting room for just a bit of ambience when watching a movie or something, you know, that kind of a thing. Just to be able to dim it and control it, not even the color aspect of it, you know.
Like, I wonder, is it going to be like this for another few years? Like, from what you're saying, David, it does seem like the most rational sort of choice to kind of do a DIY route. But, it, you know, it's clear that you don't want to. If there was a reasonable sort of relatively low cost set of solutions that you could easily plug into other stuff, like, that's the route you go down. Like, do you have any hope that this will all change in the future, or is this always going to be a bit niche?
I think when people start, like, we're so ridiculously connected. We always have a phone in our hand. We always have, you know, a lot of people have smartwatches now. Even I see a lot of people with the 50 euro smartwatches from AliExpress. That do, I don't know exactly what they do, but I've seen a few of them around. But I think it's kind of, the time is now, but like it's going to take someone like Apple to properly get behind it and to, you know, like, I suppose you just have to buy into an ecosystem and stick there and
not cry when it goes out of business.
Yeah, and I mean, I think if the Samsung Smart Things is a hub that will work with anything, so it just kind of sits there and its whole kind of purpose is to just be an aggregator. So it's one way to solve the problem, essentially. You know, but again, it's another piece of equipment. It's another thing to do, you know?
It seems weird to me that they didn't extend Apple TV to be some sort of home hub, because you think like Apple TV, which, you know, really power efficient.
Oh, well, they did.
Oh, so.
But I don't know, does it have a UI or anything, but the whole point was that if you have an Apple TV, your lights will be able to turn on and off when you're not at home and you can do all the program stuff. So essentially you need the Apple TV if you want to use timers.
Okay, but you still need another hub. Like, the Apple TV isn't your HomeKit hub. You have to buy a system that also incorporates a hub, and the Apple TV talks to that hub. Is that basically it?
It depends, you know. a device could be its own hub, or it might need a hub, or like with the LiFX ones, you have to get a Raspberry Pi yourself and run software. I think you sent me a version of it, to, you know, to essentially act as a HomeKit bridge. So the whole thing is incredibly messy. And unless you want to spend a load of money with the full knowledge that you'll be throwing everything out in a year or two, I don't think it's worth it. I think the one thing that you could possibly invest in is the Philips Hue lights.
They've been around for quite a while as well, right?
They've been around for quite a while. I'm hesitant to buy all the LiFX ones, because essentially they don't support HomeKit, but HomeKit support has been coming for like 2 years now, and there's no real update on it. So if I buy a load of them and then they're like, oh yeah, HomeKit, but only on our new bulbs, or something like that, you know, if it's not coming to the original ones, then you know, it's just a lot of hassle. And again, our Raspberry Pi running, you know, it's nearly easier to just go Philips Hue. I wouldn't buy a Nest because I don't trust Google to keep it alive, you know. So it's, yeah, Philips Hue, I think, is the only thing that you could actually invest in any significant monetary terms at this point. For me, anyway. And the LiFX bulbs are better as bulbs, but Philips is better as an ecosystem. So again, you've pros and cons, like.
Cool.
Yeah, oh, that was a digression, but sure.
Is there anything else we want to say about Sierra? I have to say, Dave, I think this year of all years, you really aren't missing out very much.
Definitely not. No.
Yeah, like, I assume they've brought the stuff from photos into it, and you can detect horses and stuff.
I actually haven't even tried it.
And I think, I think picture-in-picture is it. Because I remember giving out about it when they brought it out for the iPad Pro. That, you know, you still couldn't really do it. Like, you could make a VLC always on top, but it still wasn't perfect. I think we actually might have talked about it in one of the earlier podcasts. So that would be enough to actually get me to upgrade sooner rather than later. And if the resolution is good enough, so not on my MacBook Air, but, you know, even watching programming videos, I think, Baz, you said something about that, and programming at the same time.
Yeah, well, I wasn't watching programming videos, but yeah, you could just definitely watch programming videos and have it going at the same time without having to flip back between, because it always stays in the front, you know.
So I think on the positive side of not much changing is I haven't seen much stuff break. You know, I tried some of my slightly more janky apps just to see, but yeah, they don't seem to. I mean, so this is great and all, because there's nothing worse than a big Mac release that sort of changes lots of stuff and breaks lots of stuff. But on the flip side, then, you know, there is, I suppose, a bit of a danger that the platform is allowed to stagnate, right? Every year it might get one or two of the features that came to iOS before, but other than that, it's sort of, I don't know.
And was this build as a stability release, like the same way that Snow Leopard and Mountain Lion were?
Not explicitly.
Yeah.
I guess it's something to keep an eye on. I mean, you know, this has been our debate for a very long time, you know. How long more is the Mac going to last?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that this is the first release that has fallen off. As far as I know, my late or mid-2008 MacBook.
Oh, yes, your brother's one.
Can no longer upgrade to it.
Yeah, so as far as I know, that's no longer on the compatibility list.
I read up about this, and apparently it's relatively arbitrary, the cutoff. Like, there's no technical reason why those machines cut off. It doesn't correspond to any graphics card changes or any other hardware differences. So it's just literally them saying, oh, those machines are kind of old. So
yeah, they should have made them worse so that they'd have broken by now. As that is 8 years?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Which is pretty good running to, you know, it's a pretty good thing to have always up-to-date software on a computing device.
It is, and that it's still brilliant, like, put new RAM in it and hard disk there recently, and it's brand new, like, still. And it's Core 2.
Was that one of the last ones you could put RAM into?
I wouldn't. There was a few years afterwards, but yeah, it's one of the, you know, you can still take out the battery and all that good stuff. And the keyboard broke, and we fully disassembled it and ordered a new keyboard off eBay, and put the keyboard into it and reassembled it. You know, just, it's nice, like, you could actually do things. Whereas now, like, if anything goes in this thing, it's just going to the bin, like. So.
On that, topics, somebody pointed out, after the iPhone event, that it has been a year and a half since any Mac hardware appeared on stage at an Apple event.
Yeah, well, over 1,000 days since the last Mac Pro or whatever the dustbin one was.
But maybe this is a kind of flip side to what we're just talking about. So, you know, Dave, your MacBook Air is 4 years old. If you had an iPhone that was 4 years old, you would sort of feel, oh, that's a long time, you know, that it's time to upgrade. My sense is, like, your machines are perfectly good enough for all your needs.
Yeah, well, like, I mean, I have a Core i7 and 8 gigs of RAM, like.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, same. It's not, it was never a slouch, and it still isn't. Like, I mean, I use this for everything. I do all my development on it. I do, like, literally, it's my only machine, apart from a Windows 7 with 1 gig of RAM at work, like. And that's, well, you know, it feels like 1 gig of RAM. It's not actually 1 gig of RAM. And this does everything. And if it ever gets a bit slow or anything, like, I'll do, it's not called expose anymore, but, you know, I'll do that thing where it shows all the windows and realize that I have 5,000 windows open. and that even though there's technically that app sleep or whatever, that, you know, there's, I just restart it and uncheck, open, reopen Windows after reboot, and it's as fast as anything then until it eventually gets a bit slow again. But we're talking 6 months, like, you know.
So here we have it where, you know, you guys are running 4-year-old laptops and perfectly happy with it. There's no new Mac hardware, but in some senses, apart from the newness, you know, maybe things are sort of, this is just how things are, you know? Like, I know Intel's sort of release schedule with their new chips and their new processors has been delayed and has, you know, it's that they've moved away from the TikTok strategy. But yeah, I don't know. Something like, it feels like the OS isn't getting updated very much anymore. The hardware isn't getting updated very more. What we have is grand. There's, you know, OS X is still the best desktop operating system. The laptops are still, I think, superior to most of the stuff in the PC world.
Yeah, to be honest, I think, like, had there been no innovation since Mountain Lion, I'd be happy in software terms. Like, I don't need any of this iCloud crap.
Yeah, I just feel bad. Yeah. I feel bad for, like, just the people who are on the fence that, you know, having a new machine that comes out every year or two, a frequency to when the machines are coming out. Because people are just not upgrading machines. Some people now, we are lucky that our machines are fine. Mine is actually only about 3 years old, but people's machines are dying out at the moment. And a lot of people are looking to upgrade to the next MacBook and they don't want to buy one yet. They just want to know when is the next one coming out so they can make up their mind. They want to know prices and stuff like this, so they don't want to get caught out. I feel bad for people like that. I think, yeah, I don't know, a bit of a regular upgrade, you know, even just RAM or, you know, your processor or something like that, that, yeah, you want to buy another MacBook product and you kind of, you don't want to wait around. It's annoying. So there needs to be,
I think we talked about another podcast where you always get the latest, like, you know, doesn't pay to get a step down from the latest, like, you know,
that's it. It's just, even communication from Apple is lousy. That, why can't they just tell people when the next one's coming out so people can kind of plan for it that way? With the iPhones, you know what you're getting, you know? So they're not going to say until a couple of days or a couple of weeks beforehand when they're coming out. Fine. They're going to come out every year anyway. When you're waiting around 4 years for a MacBook or whatever, 3 years, it's kind of...
Can you say that again, Baz?
Just if you're waiting around for, like, a MacBook for 3 years, it probably does get annoying when you just want to hand over the money, you know, and not get screwed over.
So there is one reason why we haven't seen Macs in a million years. Because maybe deep inside Cupertino, they're working on a different sort of Mac.
Yeah.
So this was all... this is, I guess... Jeff Atwood is where I first saw it. And basically, when the iPhone 7s came out, when they started getting into people's hands... Some people did some Geekbench benchmarks. And Geekbench is a series of tests designed to give some numerical measure of a computer's performance, no matter how imperfect. His original tweet was, the CPU in the iPhone 7 is roughly similar performance-wise to Intel's top-of-the-line Sandy Bridge Core i7 in 2011. So I guess, are we getting to the stage where the performance of ARM chips are high enough that they could replace Intel on the Mac line?
Yeah, I think so, because I did, again, Jeff Atwood tweeted the Google Octane results, and, like, the iPhone 7 is faster than my MacBook that I'm recording this on right now, for that particular benchmark, which is always fun. So yeah, I think it's interesting that the Apple have put the pieces in place gradually with Bitcode, et cetera. I think we talked about this, maybe in the last podcast. That, you know, you're uploading essentially an intermediate representation of the code to the App Store now. If you want, it's mandatory for Apple TV and watch apps, and I have no doubt it'll be made mandatory for the other platform soon, and that would allow them to recompile on the fly for a different architecture.
So Apple have been through two architecture transitions in the history of the Mac. So the first being 68K to PowerPC, which I guess I don't know that much about. But the second one being the transition, which I did go through, between PowerPC and Intel. And certainly kind of the last time round, it seemed like they'd put a lot of thought into the transition. Remember, we had these fat binaries with a... So universal binaries, I guess they're called.
Yeah, and we had Rosetta as well.
So we had a native translation layer. Well, we had a translation layer to run legacy apps. And we also had, they also get the developers the ability to ship universal apps, run them both. And I guess one of the things I'm wondering is that how software is distributed has changed an awful lot since the sort of the PowerPC to Intel transition. And I wonder, does that make it significantly easier to do a processor architecture transition? So for example, software isn't shrink wrapped basically anymore. You're not buying disks. And in a lot of cases where, you know, developers have built Mac apps sort of with modern version of Xcode, like, for a lot of apps, is it really just going to be, you know, recompiling with different compiler flags and you could be done? Or is that too optimistic?
It sounds to me like if you've uploaded it to the App Store with bitcode, you do nothing. And Apple will do it for you.
Which is incredible, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose that it's one of the benefits of the walled garden that we don't necessarily think about. They could theoretically, assuming these don't use 86 assembly or something like that, you can literally just start compiling or producing targets for whatever you want.
I think the only downside I can see is, I guess this is more maybe developers, but people have to run Windows in a VM.
Yeah.
So I guess that's where you'd have to add another virtualization layer that isn't needed. Because Intel are quite clever about this. I think they have some... I don't really understand the tech, but how VMs can access the bare metal of the hardware right now, because...
They're almost not virtual machines. Like, you know, they're fairly well managed.
So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. I know some people are, you know, a little bit skeptical that this is going to happen. I added some links. Oh, yes. Thunderbolt. This is my other thing. Thunderbolt is owned by Intel. So the question is, if they went to ARM, does that mean that Intel wouldn't give them a license to develop their own Thunderbolt chip? So they'd have to, I guess, do DisplayPort over USB-C, which you can get a fair whack of resolution through. So maybe this is how the transition is going to work out, that basically these new ARM Macs are just going to have USB-C ports. They won't be Thunderbolt like the MacBook is now. But, you know, they'll be able to drive the display support over USB supports 8K at 60 hertz.
For one screen?
Yeah.
Or could it do two? 4Ks?
Oh, I'm looking at the tech specs. Yeah.
When you're talking about these new MacBooks, are you talking about like all replacing all MacBooks, including Pros?
I think it'll be gradual over time.
The okay. MacBook One or whatever they call it would be the logical place to start, yes. Obviously.
Right, yeah. Yeah, just, you know, I was thinking about those power users, I guess.
What I think would be a way to do this, not so much stealthily, but would be to include a core, an ARM core inside of one of the laptops.
Ooh.
In addition to the Intel. and they could say that it's for running iPad apps on, you know, iPad and iPhone apps natively on the phone.
Okay.
And, you know, so you get this kind of hybrid, and then after a while they're like, well, you can run any app you want on the ARM core, you know. Now, obviously, that is ridiculously complicated. But there could be some, you know, you could actually have an ARM core running iOS inside in your Mac at the start for a while. And eventually things start to spill out.
I think one of the things just so exciting that there is some innovation in the processor space, not only by Apple, but just in the ARM world, just seems to be moving so much faster. Because what's happening on the Intel side, just there seems to be nothing going on.
Yeah, I think it sounds to me like they've painted themselves into a corner with their architecture or whatever, because they had a great boost there when they brought out the Core Duo, I want to say 11, 12 years ago now. And that was a new architecture, a new pipeline, all that sort of stuff. And they've been kind of building on it, but obviously it's not, I don't know what's happening with it.
Yeah, and in the early, so that kind of roundabout coincides with the Apple Intel transition, like almost all Intel Macs were Core Duo. I think there might have been a Core Solo Mac Mini. Am I right? I think so. But in the early days of the Intel Macs, there were pretty significant speed increases. You know, it's only the past few years that it's really leveled off.
Mm. And I think it's obviously it's just a factor. Like, I mean, the whole market is, you know, PC is commoditized at this point, and Mac to a certain extent. I think one of the things that's driving the PC side of things with the graphics cards and stuff is VR. And like, that's, if I was getting a PC or whatever, that would be the reason. I'd imagine. I won't, like, but you know, your man, is it Palmer Lucky or whatever, said that, you know, basically, you know, in addition to the funding Trump meme army, said that Apple don't make a Mac powerful enough to run the Oculus, basically. Which, you know, I'm going to assume is true. And it is annoying, even for the non-gaming aspects of this that we talked about before, like with that space virtual desktop thing. So Apple have been working with another Mac, or rumored anyway, in the Wall Street Journal, McLaren, the Formula One race team. So Apple car or composite materials for new devices?
We really haven't talked about the Apple car very much.
No, I don't know how much substance there is to it. Like, I mean, I know there's rumors of that, whatever that treadmill for cars. I don't know, whatever you call it. There's rumors of people hearing one of them in an Apple-owned location in San Francisco late into the night and stuff like that. But I'm just wondering, I don't know, is it realistic? It could be something. I've heard that it's something they're doing to keep Johnny Ive at Apple, and that maybe he wants to, again, rumors, like, that's what they have to do to keep him there. And let him design a car.
I don't know. It's an interesting one. Like, I'm quite interested in cars. I was even a very enthusiastic Formula One fan at one point. Because cars are like physical devices, the way that kind of electronics aren't, in that, you know, ultimately they are defined by their interface on the road. I know we said this before the phone as well, like that sort of quote about PC guys aren't just going to walk in here, but given the nature of car design is so expensive, it necessarily has to be conservative, because of safety standards and stuff. I just wonder how much value Apple could add in this area. And I think that they are working on a car, but I don't know. I kind of think there are other areas of life where they could make much more of an impact.
Yeah, and as well, like, I mean, if you take Apple's typical approach to things and apply that or scale it up to a car, it's not the car I want, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Like,
my car gets cut off from OS 10 updates now, and that's it. And I can't get new versions of apps for my car. And, you know, just it just, I don't know, if it's some kind of fancy car play or some system that manufacturers would adopt, yeah, I could see that. But just overall,
what if it's a converter to make your car self-driving? No car, just the self-driving part.
That's
a couple of cameras.
Your man, Geohot.
Geohot. Yeah.
Is it a Kickstarter or is it an actual release for that?
I'm not sure. Which is, he's released something for like $1,000
self-driving unit. Something. Yeah.
Pretty cool.
That'll work with pretty much any car, and I can't remember the name of it. Something AI.
Yeah, George Hotz. Anyway, is your man's name.
I don't know, like, clearly the hype machine about self-driving cars is huge at the moment. I don't know, it bores me.
Comma.ai.
Also, the other thing about a potential Apple car is that up until, like, take the iPhone, for example, which is an incredibly expensive device. By global standards, like most people in the world can't afford them. But at least we're getting to the stage where most people could actually... There's a lot of people now who are beginning to be able to afford one, like say in some parts of Asia. Whereas like, you know, the three of us are part of the 1%, but there's no way in hell we'd ever be able to afford an Apple car. Like this is sort of stuff of kind of... The 1%, you know? And I think that's some of the least attractive aspects of Apple. Wouldn't necessarily say under the Tim Cook era, but under the Johnny Ive era, is this sort of... And Dave, you made the point that maybe they're just doing the car to keep Johnny Ive occupied, which I think is probably a good guess. And I just think that luxury, that the sort of the Hermes bands and the stuff... That's not cool. Like, it's fashion and...
Yeah. Because I think as well, if you take a look at the iPhone, like, as you said, there's a bit of trickling down with that. You know, there's the secondhand iPhones, there's stuff like that. But if you take a look at the luxury car market, it's essentially people buy them and keep them and they're in good condition. And poor people aren't buying old luxury cars.
And especially now, because we've had a glimpse to the future. Like before, people would keep like old Mercs. There's the W124, which was sort of the main small Merc when I was young. And I still want one. You know, as these things become software based, that kind of luxury used to mean sort of like mechanically well engineered, and now it means something completely different. So,
And I think as well, like the, you know, let's say you have someone who, like, you know, I know that the running cost of one of these luxury cars pretty much stays the same regardless, because, you know, it's one thing. Look, if you have a car that you can go and get motor factor parts for, that's fine. But like, if you have a Merc or a BMW or something, you're not, you know, what's the point in having that if you're going to, you know, get your replacement parts off eBay or something? Like, you know, the running cost of the car doesn't decrease with the age the same way that, you know, you just buy an iPhone and it's old and it's cheaper. You know, the car will be cheaper, but the running cost will probably be the same. You know, so it's not something that, you know, it's not something that you can say, oh, I'll buy a used whatever. You know, you're still going to have to get it serviced. You're still going to have to get it repaired with genuine parts. And especially if it's an Apple, like, you know, you're not going to be, you know, it'll tell you this part is incompatible. You know, I'm sorry, I can't let you, you know, can't let you put that oil in. And then they'll have the speakers will squirt you with oil or something to get it out of the system because you used the wrong type, like, or, you know.
And to give you an example of this, so I drive a 2008 Peugeot Partner van, a very glamorous method of transport, befitting my glamorous life as a technology entrepreneur. But the stereo has an aux port in the back. It's a non-standard connector, but that there is an aux port there. The only way you can enable this port is by getting a dealer to do it. So even like a third party tool that, you know, you plug into the OBD2 port or whatever, you can't. It's completely locked down. Like, this is the way car manufacturing is going. And it stinks and whatever, but it feels, for Apple to sort of go into the very high end of that market, just feels a bit boring. Like, if they want to think about transport, like, surely, I don't know, I just kind of think luxury is one way to go, but is that really what Apple are about? Because that's not why I started using Macs, or, you know, why I was so excited when the first iPhone came out. It, like, I didn't feel it was a luxury product. Like, yeah, Macs have always been expensive, and they used to be horrendously expensive. But there's that sense of, they were expensive because they were made to be the best they could be. I just worry about this sort of slip into ostentatious kind of consumerism is just, yeah, it's a bit meh.
Yeah, and especially considering that that's what the market seems to be, and that's what the analysts are all about as well. You know, so if this does go this way, like, I mean, Apple share price is going to be a lot more volatile.
Mm.
Maybe. You know, do I have to disclose that, like, that now I have I'm saving money in, like, a fund that has Apple shares? Then that, like, you know, this podcast could be manipulating the market, you know? Literally like a college fund for like about 20 really? Years time. Yeah, yeah.
So a US ETF, is it? Or is it a managed fund?
Managed for this, just low enough yield. It's more just to preserve the inflation than to actually go reckless. I've different plans for that. So
cool. So Apple is part of the sensible bet.
Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, disclosure there, you know, just in case I rock the stock market with my fabulous insight.
Now go out and buy the new iPhone 7, kids, because Dave needs to send his kid to college.
That's it. What's making us happy this week?
Who wants to go first?
You go first, Beth.
Me go first. Yeah, so I guess since... I don't know. After we talked in a previous podcast about mine and Dave's very first game being no longer in the App Store, kind of irked me a little bit. So I guess since last Sunday, I woke up and I started remaking the game in Objective-C, because originally it was written in C++. So for the last kind of week, in the evenings, an hour here, an hour there, and yeah, this weekend, I guess a lot of time this weekend, I've been working on making the game again, just for funds, just to see, because it's kind of funny, Dave, isn't it? Because, like, I don't think we knew much Objective-C back then.
No, it was to be avoided like the plague. Like, I mean, we bought the books, but the first books were crap.
Oh, I don't think we'd ever even made an app, maybe a few demo tutorials or something, as you said, from the books. But yeah, it's just kind of, it's funny to see, what do I know now after, I don't know how many years, 20 years of iOS development, it feels like, kind of putting my best practices into practice and making a game. And I'm not making it in a game engine, because it's a very, very simple game. It's something I think can be done in just regular Xcode. But yeah, it's kind of been fun. You know, everything kind of has come together over the last day or two, and putting in little bits of polish and sparkles here and there. So it's kind of been fun. And I suppose the three of us have been messaging back and forward on it, getting input from you guys and stuff like that. So it's been interesting. I don't know what to do next. should I get people to test it?
Or? Yeah, I suppose the main thing that I'm interested in is just realistically how development has changed from starting a project back then to starting a project now. Because look, it did take us 2 weeks back then. That was it. Like, we'd written in 2 weeks, and then it was polish.
Was that including everything, animations and all that?
It was
graphics.
Essentially, yeah, but we were just tweaking stuff after that. Like, I mean, the game right, was feature yeah. complete.
Yes, yes.
After 2 weeks, and I think we just did some playability tweaks, and we were just the last 90% of, you know, figuring things out and making sure that everything worked decently. And
the scary part, yeah.
Testing it on, rounding up everyone's devices.
I guess at the time it was, the only difference in phones was, I think, going to a Retina phone. So when we started doing apps, there was no Retina phones. So we had to do 2X graphics. For now, auto layout's been really good. So I know straight away that auto layout, it will work on any phone or iPad. And a bit of maths then to figure out how to tile their size and everything like that. So yeah, just with a bit of maths and a bit of auto layout, yeah. It's off. A lot of it's done for you.
And like when we wrote this, I think like Interface Builder was a separate app.
Oh god!
and you had to open it, like you opened your nibs, which weren't yeah. zibs. I don't, or maybe they were, but in Interface Builder,
I think they were. Yeah.
You know, and it used crash loads.
Yeah.
And like,
our layout's so good yeah. though. Just kind of going. 10% here, 90% there, you That's know, it. In layout. Just kind of
and
go,
to yeah. get the performance, even for a tile game, like we essentially had to use OpenGL, you know, so that yeah. the whole thing was an OpenGL ES2 engine in C++.
Yeah.
Totally over-engineered.
I tried running. It's cool. I guess there was ideas to use the engine more yeah. and... I suppose there is still a few videos of me using the engine for different animations and stuff out there on the YouTubes, yep. Which is kind of cool. So yeah, it was good. And I referenced the app today after how many years, Dave? 6 years?
Five years? Yeah, five since it came out, Christ. But it's probably six.
Yeah, so I went back to reference the code to see how you did something today that I was struggling with. So, you know, it's kind of cool. Yeah. Kind of come full circle again. So you never know. I suppose we can talk about this more in the future and talk about differences in the app changing or app development over the years and what it was like making the game back in the day. And maybe we'll have, yeah, maybe we might release the game again.
Yeah, why not?
Full of in-app purchases.
Yeah, there's no use.
There's no
and
use.
Double the amount of queues. So if you want use, you can purchase them. You can purchase a pack of 10 use for 99
yeah.
cents.
And you, yeah. And if you don't get over X amount of points per game, you have to buy tries for 99 cents for five
yeah,
tries.
Yeah, and you can subscribe to the Word of the Day edition. Where if you subscribe and if you get the, every time you start, it's like the word of the day is banana. And if you spell the word of the day, then you get more imaginary points that you can spend on more useless crap.
Yeah. Sounds like the way of the future. I think it's going to be a relatively old school app. I just don't know how to manage those ideas, you know. They just seem like a nightmare, really. I don't want to have to
That's
touch
kind
them.
Of the problem when you, especially when you just build the app up front or build the game up front, kind of retrofitting decisions into it afterwards is always difficult, and leaving out the fact then that you actually have to deal with different SDKs and stuff like that.
Yeah. So I guess one of the challenges is leaderboards and Game Center and what we might do there.
Yeah.
So, okay. So that's what's making me happy this week. It's kind of been fun to work on a game again. Thomas, Dave, do we talk about your house yet?
I don't know. I suppose, yeah. It's not tech-like. Well, it is, I suppose. Yeah, so what's making me happy is I am now a homeowner. So for how long that makes me happy, it remains to be seen. But yeah, so in the middle of very stressful time at the moment where I'm working, doing a master's, 9-month-old baby, moving house, and Denise is going back to maternity leave next week.
Oh, really? Oh, dude.
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting down in the evenings in my spare time programming away, not a care in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
I suppose you're almost there with the kind of, You'll be there at the moving soon anyway, won't
you? Yeah, that's it. And I mean, the thing is, I need the internet for everything. So I have to get that wired up. There's no line in the house or anything like that. So it's just waiting. And then, of course, the providers, they'll give you the TV and make you sign the year's contract on the TV before they come out and do the internet and hook that up. So that's fun. So hopefully by the end of tomorrow, there'll be some kind of internet.
Yeah. It's important, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It is, but even...
Don't be tethered.
You know what I mean? Look, I need it for work. I need it for pretty much everything. Yeah. The 3G is bad, non-existent. So it's literally no internet. And given how I operate, like, you know, get ready for work, you know, spend 20 minutes just doing stuff at night before bed for work in the morning or whatever. Refreshing things, like, you know, I need the internet for that. So, yeah. Yeah, that's it anyway. So, as I said, I'm sure the excitement will ramp up once I'm in there and then ramp down once the mortgage payments kick in.
And then all the bills will be coming in.
And stuff going wrong and you've nobody to call to fix them.
Yeah.
No, it's going to be awesome.
Ah, totally, yeah. No, I'm over the moon, as one would say. Just kind of that one of those times where you can't really think straight, you know. It's kind of like, I have no idea what I'm doing, but you're just keep doing it as quick as you can, as fast as you can.
So I got something for this week. It's a small thing. And it is an app. And the reason why I mention it is because it's a paid app and nobody buys paid apps anymore, as we know. But this is definitely an app that I think, or a class of app that I think everybody should spend money on. Because I don't think any of the free ones offer the same functionality. So it's these apps have been around for ages. It's an app that allows you to scan PDFs using a camera. The one I use,
and that's why my phone keeps beeping.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, I'm testing out. So the app I use is Scanner Pro. Readl are the developers. The reason why I was texting you guys is they have an iMessage app. So it's the only app that I have installed is in Messages. So I was just sending you guys PDFs to see what it did.
You scanned this PDF from your phone?
From Messages. Oh, sorry.
That's cool, because like I can copy in all the text.
Oh, no, sorry, that was the second one. I was just comparing the two.
I thought that was good.
But the nice thing what Scanner Pro does is that it does edge detection and it automatically corrects skew. So even if your camera is not fully perpendicular to the piece of paper you're scanning, it will detect the edges and turn it into an A4 thing. You can do multi-page documents. So yeah, super, super handy to have, especially Dave. I'm sure you're undergoing a bejesus amount of bureaucracy at the moment.
Yeah, and I've actually used that app a good few times. It's kind of not something I'd use the whole time, but there's the one-off when, like, you know, I have a scanner and all that, but for whatever reason, it doesn't work with the Mac without a USB cable. So I can't wirelessly scan and, or, you know, use an SD card or something. So it's a handy one to have to just use for stuff that you need to do there and then, or even someone will have something at work and they'll be like, can I scan that? And I'll just use the app to do it there and then and be done with it.
What's the name of it again?
Scanner Pro.
So from, Messages there, just, you sent us two PDFs. So it just sent as a PDF. There's nothing special about it except it just says from Scanner Pro.
Okay.
As a tagline.
So highly recommended. It's been out for a while, but definitely one day. I mean, this literally, for a lot of people, if you don't need to scan photos, this app really replaces a flatbed scanner or a scanner with an automatic document feeder. Like, you know, that's significant.
Tis, yeah. I mean, the only thing that I've found is just getting the lighting right for some of them. In places in work, like, they'd be odd, you know, and sometimes the flash has kind of washed things out a bit too much.
Yeah, the other thing I have is one of the desks in our office is it's just off-white, and so sometimes the app doesn't get the contrast it needs to detect the edges, but
Yeah, but I think it's something that if you're using it regularly and you have a place that you do it and stuff, it's brilliant. And I'm going to make it more of a habit as well, actually, recently now, because I just realized that I have so much paper that I don't really need, that I've kept just in case. You know, like literally I have boxes of paper. You know, letters, bank statements, even just the, you know, just letters, receipts, invoices, bills that I don't need, but it's kind of a just in case, you know, and just in case having a scan would be just as good.